Well, hello and welcome, everybody. This is your host, Kennedy Foster, and I'd like you to welcome you to the Voices of Courage show. You know, this is a show that I do every week for you. I like to bring on guests that have messages of truth, courage, hope, and ways for you to be able to up-level your life. Maybe let go of the past. Let go of what didn't work. Start to really realize that within you is unlimited potential. By the way, you know what stops everybody from doing their dreams? The one thing that stops everybody is the thought that they can't do it. That's it. That's what stops people, right? So if you turn that around and you say, you know what? You start asking, what is possible for me? And you just start following that inner voice of what's possible. Things that you never thought you could accomplish will be accomplished. But I have to tell you, you know, sometimes you have to move past the past. You have to let it go. You have to be in a place where you're willing to tell yourself and create a new story for your life. In fact, that's really what my guest is all about. He's a storyteller. And he's a storyteller that has put together some powerful stories that you, I believe, will be able to relate to, especially if you're somebody that wants to upshift your thinking, upshift your life, and maybe look at, you know, the dark side of your life and also the light of what's possible. You know, we can't move forward until you acknowledge where you've been. You just have to acknowledge it, right? You don't have to live in it and dwell in it, but you do have to acknowledge it. And once you acknowledge that, you have to understand that within you is the power to let anything go and start to live from the moment, right? I don't know anybody on the planet that their lives aren't filled with past mistakes. Sorry, I haven't met that person. In fact, you know, if you really tune into the mindsets of the successful, most of them have failed many, 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 many times. And their failures, though, they didn't dwell in their failures. They learned from them and they moved past it and stepped into what we would call courage, right? What is courage? Courage is an energy, it's a focus, it's a power, it's a feeling, but you don't get to have courage unless you do something that you've never done before. That's when courage shows up. It doesn't show up when you're just thinking, oh, I'd like to have more courage. No, you got to go do things that you've never done before. That's how we grow, that's how we evolve, and that's how we shift our consciousness. So we're going to be talking about some of these principles that I just mentioned, but a whole bunch more with my guest, and I got a very special guest today. So stay tuned, and I'll be right. We're going to introduce him right after the break.
Whether because of discomfort, lack of mobility, your lifestyle, or occupation, you sit inactively way too many hours a day. Introducing Ellipse, the premium quality automatic seated exerciser that strengthens legs, increases mobility, and boosts circulation without physical strain or impact.
It is so quiet that none of my coworkers even know I'm using it.
Strengthen and tone your legs. Increase your mobility, flexibility, and balance. Plus, stimulate healthy circulation.
My joints feel better, my knees feel better, my back feels better. It makes me feel stronger too.
Perfect for home therapy. Whisper quiet to use while you work.
My circulation is moving, I'm burning calories, and it makes me feel energetic.
Call now and order Ellipse, the seated exerciser that strengthens legs, increases mobility, and boosts circulation. Call and get upgraded to the deluxe bundle. Get the faster motor for 5 miles of steps per hour, the step counter, the sport mat, and wireless remote. Call now.
Well, welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Kennedy Foster. I'm very, very honored to have Andre Joseph here today with me as my guest. Andre, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Kendall. It's an honor to be on today with you.
You know, a lot of people know your films but don't know you. So this is going to be a great interview, I believe. You know, for those of you that don't know Andre Joseph, he began his independent filmmaking when he was only 13 years old. He later graduated from Emerson College with a bachelor's degree in film and went on to found his own production company, AJ Epex Productions, Epex, E-P-Y-X, Epex. His film Vendetta Games won the Best Urban Action Film at Cinemax-sponsored 2017 Urban Action Showcase and now streams on Amazon Prime. And we're talking about today your trilogy and the last movie in the series, The Last Vendetta. But before we get into that, listen, 13 years old, how did you get inspired at 13 to want to make films?
You know, it kind of began for me just always watching cartoons, Disney movies, anything that my parents had available at home or when they were renting videos back in the late 80s. And for me, it was watching these films, watching these shows, and I was a big avid toy collector. So I would take my figures and I was always reenacting the stuff that I was seeing on television most of the time. And especially when there were big movies coming out, like a new Ghostbusters or a new Batman, I was always out trying to get the action figures. And at the same time, I used to go to my grandmother's apartment in Brooklyn and my cousins would be there. And we were always doing different skits from different movies we were watching. My uncle, who was living with her at the time, had just gotten a video camera. And we were like, hey, let's try to get the camera and let's start filming some of these skits. But we were like 10, 12 years old. He didn't trust us with having, you know, a couple hundred dollars worth of equipment that we would end up breaking. So we were always just writing different ideas for a long time. And then I was on a vacation at 13 in South Carolina with my mom. And we made a couple of friends on our trip. And we just came with the idea of let's do a murder mystery story around our hotel. And my mom had just gotten the VHS camera and we convinced her to let us use it as long as she was running the camera. That was kind of the beginning of the long journey of me eventually getting my own camera, dragging my friends to do the backyard short films on the weekends. And at a certain point, it became such an intense hobby that I started thinking to myself, I could probably do this as a legit career. I don't want to be a doctor. I don't want to, you know, follow in all these other paths. I think this is it. This is the art for me. And my parents weren't so sure. So they said, well, let's put him in New York Film Academy for the 4-week summer program. Let's see if he really likes it and sees the reality of how to make a film. And that's where, yeah, I started to learn how to block actors, do lighting, having to load the old 16mm cameras that they used during World War II. And it was very intense, but I came out of it even more inspired to say, I could really do this. It's not that difficult, even though later on I would find the challenges with that, but it just became a passion that became something much greater than just a hobby. And it became my dream to get to this point, to talk to you and to talk about my work.
Well, you know, it sounds like you had really supportive parents because, you know, they obviously recognize your talent and were able to support you in that. You know, you end up in Emerson College, which is no easy feat in itself. How did that shape your vision going to Emerson?
You know, it was actually between Emerson and NYU. And my dream was to go to NYU just because Martin Scorsese and Spike Lee went there. And I remember my SAT scores were not the greatest. I'll be perfectly honest. So I was rejected at least twice in trying to get into that school. And so I ended up getting my gen eds at a community school in Florida just because I wanted to just get off of New York for a little bit. And then I had the opportunity as a transfer student to either go to NYU or go to Emerson. But I felt that Emerson was more equal opportunity for people like me, not just to like wait until you get into a classroom to learn how to make films, but I could volunteer to work on other student films in different capacities. And at the same time, I felt they were more up to date before he was going. You know, this was at the point when the landscape of cinema was starting to shift from celluloid to digital. They had the connections and the know-how of, you know, how to do digital editing and other things. And so I felt that was the place I really wanted to be. So I was blessed to get into that school, to have some great instructors that helped to give me some out-of-the-box thinking in terms of my storytelling abilities and really never limiting me in any type of storytelling that I wanted to do, but to find ways to structure it and then figure out where can I bend, where can I break the rules a little bit so it's my voice and it's my story to tell.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's the one of the keys, of course, is the storytelling ability, you know, in your films. Where did that talent come from? I mean, is that something you developed over the years? Did you bring in writers that really had a deep, you know, connection to storytelling, or how did you get to that place?
A lot of it came from just me as I'm playing with these figures, just role playing different ideas, you know, with certain movies coming up with alternate scenarios of things that they never did in the film or the show that I could do with my figures. And also, too, just combining different ideas from hours of playing video games or hours watching a particular show from start to finish. And then, you know, having my own spin of like, well, what would I do if I wanted to maybe twist this up a bit, make it kind of my own tale, whether it's an alien invasion story or a James Bond inspired tale or something like, you know, Lethal Weapon, which was one of my favorite films growing up. You know, how do I make that interesting without it being overly comedic or overly sentimental? What can I do to make it realistic? So I think there were always like a lot of loose ideas that I was always writing down on paper or doing sketches of, because I always like sketching posters ahead of time before I even had the script. But of course, as I got into school and you start to learn the mechanics of three act structure and beats in a scene, then I was able to kind of formulate how to like write with my heart first before I write with my head to kind of revise it. Yeah. And then eventually you get feedback from other professional writers, and occasionally I'll collaborate with someone, like in this case, Last Vendetta. I collaborate with my co-star, Chris Carulla, because he had the experience in law enforcement to tell me, oh, this is an interesting angle you could take that would, you know, based on a real case. So I would always gravitate to those things to create an overall structure to my stories.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, my dad was in law enforcement. He was LAPD for 44 years, something like that. He had the longest seniority in that organization, next to one other guy. One other guy actually beat him, but 44, it was crazy. But, you know, it's with law enforcement, one thing I saw about him is that he always had a big heart. You know, he knew his craft really well. One of the best investigators out there. He knew his craft really well. And, you know, what I see sometimes in Hollywood is I see, you know, there seem to be a lot of dark films that come out with no purpose, no message, no nothing, just violence for violence sake. I don't see that in The Last Vendetta. You know, as you and I talked, you know, you created something, you know, that basically helps people to reinforce the fact that you got to let go of the past. You got to step into and not redefine yourself. I think that's what the movie's about. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it comes from my own sensibilities as a storyteller because, listen, I'm in my 40s, but I grew up watching a lot of reruns of old TV shows like Miami Vice and Hill Street Blues. And, you know, initially for me at a younger age, the attraction was the action, the spectacle, you know, guys just busting the bad guys and looking cool doing it. But then as I got older, I started to hone in on more the human elements of those shows, like the ramifications of violence on the street, how they end up taking those issues to their home life and how that affects their interpersonal relationships with their families and just psychologically. So those were things that even as I got older and I started having friends that joined the NYPD, I would go to parties sometimes and overhear these stories of, you know, officers that didn't get along with their partners or particular situations where maybe they didn't step in at the right time or just the politics of the job. These were things I was always like either mentally jotting down in my head or writing down myself when I was just, you know, in the car and just had something to write with. And, you know, going back to that very first film, Dishonorable Vendetta, which started the trilogy, a lot of it came from the idea of if you have these two guys that are loyal partners, but one of them has a very dark secret he doesn't really reveal to anybody else. And that's what's haunting him over the course of the three films is the fact that he's got this big chip on his shoulder. And it seems like no matter how much he's chasing after that little piece of redemption, it doesn't free him from the troubled history that continues to plague his life. So in many ways, this film is the rite of passage tale for all the characters, including the main character of Miller, in dealing with the past in order to get beyond the sort of, as he says in the film, like he's stuck in a phone booth at his age. He doesn't feel like he's going anywhere while everybody else is talking about retirement and going into politics. He's like, where the hell am I going here?
Yeah. So I got to take a break. We come back though. The Last Vendetta, you know, which is the latest film he just released. I want to take a little deeper dive in that, but I want to ask you, how does that film mirror your life? So we'll be right back and we'll talk a little bit about that. All right.
Imagine this is your money and someone wants to take it from you. Who is it? The IRS. Guess what? They want your money and they can take it, all of it if they want. Remember, they sent you that letter right over here that said, hey, you owe us a bunch of cash and we're going to take it from you right now. So what do? You fight back by letting our team of experts work it out with the IRS so you can keep your money. And hey, we're good at what we do. When you hire us, you get a team of guys on your side that know the IRS laws, and we'll fight really hard to save your money. So, if you owe the IRS a ton of cash and you want to keep it, call right now and learn for free how we can help you put it back in your pocket. 5 minutes of your time right now can save you thousands of dollars. And the best part, it's a free call, so please call right now.
Well, welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Kendi Foster. I'll be back in just a second with my amazing guest, Andrew Joseph. But before I do, I want to mention that you can join us on our YouTube channel. And if you do, you'll be able to subscribe to our shows there. You just go to youtube.com/@thecouragenetwork on YouTube. And I encourage you to subscribe so you can pass the shows on and share them with your family and friends and the people that you care about. So hopefully you'll take us up on that and let people know about us. Thanks. All right, Andre. How does The Last Vendetta mirror your life? Or does it? Maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
I mean, I don't consider myself to be a vengeful person. There's like me, if I have issues with people, it's never so much I'm harboring that I want to do something. But I will say professionally, there's definitely something that mirrors this film. And that's the fact that when I started out, I mean, straight out of college, I made my first movie called Priceless. And it was like a romantic tale that has a little bit of a Hitchcockian, you know, to catch a thief type of element to it. And I was really passionate about what I was doing then, even though I faced a lot of culture shock in producing it, because it was the first time I was working with real working actors, real working crew. And then even after all the hard work that I put into it, and I still remain proud of the movie to this day, I was so upset when a lot of the festivals that I really wanted to get into, many of the top tier festivals, were constantly rejecting it, and with no reason. And I felt like I was wasting my money, wasting my time. You would have certain people that say, oh, because you acted and directed in it, that, you know, they can't take that seriously, and whatever other criticisms that I heard. And it did discourage me for a little bit, and even to the point where I was just taking production assistant jobs and still dealing with a lot of nonsense when you're dealing with people that have been doing this job for 20, 30 years, and they look at you as, you know, you're a novice that can't do anything right. But the thing that happened for me was that when I went to the American Black Film Festival the following year after I made that film, I started to just take the DVD copy and I just started to show it to people that I was networking with. And a lot of the feedback was more positive than what I was getting from those quote unquote professionals. That's when it kind of made me say, what could have I done differently if I hadn't stopped myself, if I didn't listen to those naysayers? And so I think a lot of what I did in The Last Vendetta, as well as in the previous movies, was really putting a lot of myself into Miller as somebody that was constantly being so harbored by the bad times of his life that kind of defined where he is in his place, very lonely, very isolated, and very few people that he can really trust. But finding those ways to try to redeem himself, to move on with his life, even to find it through different people that may have gone through situations as he did, and forming an unlikely bond that brings him out of the darkness to show him that there is a better way beyond all the nonsense in the world.
Yeah. I'm glad I asked that question. Yeah, you know, because it gives us a little more insight in the movie. We're putting it up on the screen. You might have to move over a little bit, Andre. The other way. There you go. The Last Vendetta. It's on the screen right now. Where, by the way, I want to ask you, where can people watch this? I think you mentioned Tubi for free, and then Amazon and Flex TV and other places that are coming online. But they can get it right now, right?
Yes, it's available now on the platforms that you just mentioned. It's also a Verizon Fios. You can get it on demand if you have that. And there will be other platforms that will be announced in the coming weeks.
That's awesome, man. You know, should they watch the Last Vendetta first, or should they watch the series? You know, start with the first part of the trilogy, right? What's your hit on that?
You know, there's two thoughts that I have about that. So, in approaching the two sequels that came after the first one, I always kind of took the approach of the Mad Max films, where you could just watch each one in isolation and never really have to go back to the previous one to understand the exact story, because sometimes they explain it to you ahead of time. Additionally, there are flashbacks to the previous films that help to kind of bring the audience up to speed. But to really get a sense of the evolution of the main characters of Miller, Stokes, and Marks, the three DEA agents, and to understand why they're in the position that they're in, it's good to go back to the very first film, Dishonorable Vendetta, which is up on Amazon Prime, and then the follow-up, Vendetta Games, which you could find on Prime as well.
Yeah, very good. You know, I'm I attended my first film festival about a week ago. Now, I've never gone to an independent film festival, and I was in Santa Barbara, and there's a little town below it, the Carpinteria, and they were having their film festival, and I thought, I'm going to just go do that, because I'm having Andre on, and I know he's got a lot going on in the independent film distribution and the film festivals, and I thought, I need to at least know what I'm looking at. And, you know, when I was there and, you know, watching these films and watching these young artists come up, and some amazing films, by the way. I just thought to myself, what does it take to go from concept to put this on the screen? And, you know, there's so many hoops that people go through to do that. You know, if we got some young filmmakers watching this, you know, where do they start, Andre? Where do they start with this?
Well, I know it's always coming down to, where's the money? How do you get the money to make the film? But I believe in the philosophy of Robert Townsend, the director of Hollywood Shuffle and The Five Heartbeats, because I saw him speak at the American Black Film Festival once, and he said, it's not always about who you know, it's about how bad you want it. And one of the things that I teach young filmmakers in different venues is that with today's technology, you have cell phones that have very well-made cameras built in that can rival something that a major studio would have. You could use the resources around you, be it your friends. Maybe you could hire a professional actor that's trying to build their resume, and you get people that could help you with different facets. Just the bare bones of like simple lighting or simple audio work, and use the locations that are available to you. You could film something in your entire house with just one or two actors, and it could be a very simple genre piece. It could be a horror film. It could be a drama. It could be a comedy. Or maybe you have something a little bit more ambitious. But I would say start with what you can work with that's not going to break the bank for you. And gradually, if you put it out on YouTube and you can build a following from that, then you use that following to help you to build to bigger projects down the line. And you could crowdfund for that. You could sign up for grants to get those bigger projects funded. There are so many opportunities, and the work is out there. But to start and to really get into this, you just got to practice on your own, because as good as the schools may be in showing you different filmmakers' works and how they accomplish different shots and mechanics, you really don't learn and understand the process until you're actually physically doing it.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, AI is really coming into the digital film production in a way that I'm not sure we can predict. I saw or read somewhere something that at the end of this year you'll be able to create a full length motion picture just using AI. How's that going to impact you and your filmmaking and the industry?
Oh, it's going to impact it tremendously. I mean, you see right now how you have actors that are fighting to retain their likenesses and not wanting to sign off on it after they pass on, because they don't want to have, you know, their faces being used to recreate movies that they never did or something that they never finished or whatever the case may be. I'm kind of two minds of it. There is a scare factor with where it could be going. And at the same time, I've also seen where I've taken footage from movies that maybe I didn't spend a lot of money on. And I would take like a simple shot I'm not happy with and just put in a prompt. And it gives me something that looks just as good as something that costs like $50 to $100 million. And it really blows my mind that that's even feasible. I still think you got to put the work in and try to get as much done in camera as possible. But AI can serve as a useful tool if it's used correctly. But I wouldn't totally abuse it to like make an entire film that, even as it is right now, it's still not perfected enough to make something that is realistic to the eye just yet. But maybe for animation, I see a lot of possibilities there.
Yeah. You know, I think of the actors, and I think of the great films that I've watched that you feel the actor, you know, and I don't know if AI can duplicate that. Maybe, I mean, I don't know, but you know, you just have this connection, this real feeling, and it's more than words. I don't know. Hey, what's your thought on that? Will AI be able to capture the essence of the actress, you know, singing or putting, you know, heart into the movie? Like, I question that. I don't know. Is that possible?
I mean, it could try. It could certainly get to a place where maybe it could gravitate an emotion that you wouldn't expect just from taking references. But I really do believe in the power of great acting and the subtleties and the tics that we don't always really, you know, we really take for granted when we watch a movie. If you watch somebody like a Sean Connery or a Gene Hackman or a Clint Eastwood, it's not about the way that they recite a line or some cool thing that they do in the film. Sometimes it's just when they're very still and what they could do with their eyes, their expressions, and just maybe subtle movements that I don't think you can replicate with digital technology. That's something that has to come from within. And that's what makes those characters on screen so amazing, is what human element those actors and actresses bring to the screen that no amount of CGI could ever truly replicate.
It doesn't seem like it. And, you know, a lot of acting is on the screen. I mean, you know, there's a script, but then, you know, the great actors take it and make it their own. So I wonder. That's my question. I think one of the greatest things that I'm not sure AI will ever replace is great storytelling, though. Maybe it can. It does pretty good with telling stories and stuff. But I'm wondering what your hit on that is.
I mean, it could be used with something like ChatGPT to help you get out of a writer's block if you just need to generate an idea and you may struggle with trying to put it down on paper. But I definitely do believe that the only disadvantage is, again, it just takes whatever references are out there and it's not really giving you anything that's inherently original. Great stories for me come from real life experiences and things that really are plausible to happen, or you could take an allegory through something in a sci-fi or a horror movie, but there's still something that's grounded and rooted in real world things that go on. Like, I did a movie called Dismissal Time, which was loosely based on a particular incident that happened to me when I was in high school. And I couldn't just make that as somebody else's story. It had to be something that I know I lived. And there may be those who think, well, that can't happen today. But no, I mean, these are things that are so unique that they don't ever get reported on the news. They never really get into the newspapers because it's something that's closed in and internal. And only somebody like myself living that experience can put that on paper. I can't do that with AI program.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, from my point of view, I think we're all here learning, growing, evolving. And I think film brings that to light in a lot of times. I've seen so many wonderful movies in my world. I look forward to seeing The Last Vendetta because, you know, it's not just pure entertainment. I like being entertained, of course. But I also like stories that give me insight into my own world, into my own life, and maybe how I can look at justice a different way or loyalty a different way. Or maybe, you know, I've been betrayed. You know, we've all been betrayed. How do I deal with that, you know? And I know you insert that in your films. Is that one of the reasons they're so popular, do you think? Or where do you go with that? Because I know, like I mentioned earlier in Hunt, you know, Hollywood's got a bad rap in some of the really dark stuff that came out and still comes out just to scare people, right? And I guess people like being scared or something, but that's not my head. But it's not where I want to go. But I'm just wondering what your thought about that is again.
I think why it's resonating, and this is just from people that I've spoken to, is that it really, these films sort of throw back to a particular period in cinema where you can make an action film and somehow you see yourself into those characters. One of the great things that made the original Lethal Weapon with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover so great was not necessarily the big action spectacle, but their relationship and the idea of a suicidal cop and a family man finding themselves bonding through each other because Gibson's character, he lost his wife and then finds a new family through Danny Glover. Well, Danny Glover, you know, he wants to retire. He feels like he's ready to go out. And then circumstances make him realize he's got a little bit of an edge left in him. And those are things that I think people can easily relate to in their friendships in general, not just if you're in police work. So I think that really it's this idea of having friends that, you know, are bonded, but when one has so much to hold back and harbor, to the point where it becomes very volcanic and it affects that partnership, you start to ask yourself, you know, can you really confide in that person? Is this person that I thought I always knew something else that maybe is really more disturbing to me? And how do I reconcile that? So I think there's a lot of that in play because it's the last chapter of an entire trilogy. And then, you know, you deal with real world politics, you deal with real world things that go on in police work and justice. But the main crux of it is the people on the ground and the moral conflicts that they face over the course of the story.
Yeah, that's really good. I'll shift gears a little bit here. I'm wondering about, I read that you completed this film in like 21 days, something like that. What the heck? That's very quick to do that. You must have faced a ton of challenges to be able to do that. What's the secret? What'd you do?
The secret for this one was simply, we didn't shoot like 21 days consecutively. It had to be on the days when we knew we had our actors available. So my trick that I kind of learned in this particular case was to get the actors' availabilities at least a month out in advance, and then I could book the dates that I needed for them to be on set along with the crew. And so, you know, if I knew I didn't need an actor for like 2-3 months, they would be cast right away. But then I would tell them, okay, this is the time frame we're going to do this. I'll come back to you a month in advance to let you know, okay, these are the dates we're looking at. And then I would coordinate everything from there. And when it came to extras and background players, then we pretty much put out casting calls with those days locked in, knowing, okay, we need a cattle call for those actors for a particular time frame. So that was kind of the secret sauce on that. And thankfully, there were no incidents on this one. You know, you may have some testy times. You may have moments, especially when we did the finale. There's a lot of action going on. So that had to be done in like an 8-hour day in the middle of the daytime. So you're fighting with the sunlight. But we were really blessed because the crew knew how to move very quickly by that point. And we had a great stunt choreographer in Mako-san, who also plays the villain Jeremiah in the film. He kept everybody safe. We practiced everything ahead of time. And he was a godsend for us, without a doubt, because he really made sure that nobody got hurt on that film. And at the same time, we created some really amazing fight sequences.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, You know, congratulations on the trilogy. I know that you got to be, you know, proud. You got the Best Urban Action Film Award and many other awards for the trilogy. You know, as an independent filmmaker, you know, there's so many independent filmmakers. You know, you're standing out above the rest. How does that make you feel? What do you get there?
I every day I do feel like I'm still trying to find my way in this business as it's evolving and it's changing. But what I do find is something that I think I was always aspiring to look for when I was much younger. And I say this in the sense that going to different panel discussions or workshops back when I was in college, you were always getting like sort of the underbelly of the business, that it's not the sugar-coated thing where everybody's happy and working, but that it's a lot of laborious work. And sometimes it really is like this do or die type of situation. If you don't make it, you're not going to be successful. But what is making it for some people? Because for some, it may well be to be in a big budget studio picture that makes hundreds of millions of dollars, and you're going to these red carpet events and Oscars, and that's wonderful. I'm not going to knock that. But what about just doing your best work and resonating with people and connecting with an audience that you build over time? And I think I'm starting to believe in more of the latter, that there are so many opportunities and pathways now to be a success without the studio system. You can teach with this stuff. You could use your skills to make music videos, to make commercials, and you can make an income that will help you sustain a living. And it is hard work, and it is about marketing yourself and selling yourself. But the fact is, you don't need to have these middlemen anymore telling you what to do, because you have your journey and your path to follow. And that, to me, is success, more so than what the industry defines as success.
Well, you know, we got this young generation coming up. And, you know, this younger generation, you know, they not necessarily want to go into the Charlie Kirk assassination, but I want to touch on it here because we're relevant. We're Kirk. You know, they have voices that want to be heard. They have, you know, they don't necessarily want to do the things that we did in the past. And, you know, they really want to come together, I think, in a more of a unified community instead of such a segregated situation we have in like our media in so many ways. I think independent filmmaking gives people a voice to create their own legacy, to be able to step in and tell their story, you know, even, you know, and help upshift, contribute to the positivity of the world instead of the negativity of the world. What's your hit on that?
Yeah, I'm not somebody that believes in I got to impose my own politics into my films and make it so in your face. I do believe in subtlety and just coming from lived experience. And I think that's what any great filmmaker can do, is to use their experiences to craft the best story possible, and also have that collaboration with actors that maybe you might not see politically eye to eye with, but there's a human value that helps you to have that common ground. And if that objective is clear right from the jump, you could create something that's really compelling and might say a lot more than just, you know, the obvious social messaging that maybe a major studio film will try to do at the expense of maybe alienating part of their audience.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, I mean, there's, what, I don't know, 8 billion people on the planet. There's 8 billion opinions. So, I don't know if you have to take a stand. This is what I stand for or not. But I think that good filmmaking helps us to relate to our humanhood, to our, it connects us soulfully to the film, to one another. It tells a story of, you know, like in some of your films, you know, overcoming challenges, right? That we can, and it gives, you know, those, that kind of film, which is why I have you on my show. Those films are inspiring. They help uplift instead of, you know, tear down. So, what's your thought on that?
Well, I go from the Richard Donner school of, if you really want tragedy and downbeat storytelling, just watch the news. Watch these 24-hour news networks. Regardless of whatever side of aisle you're on, it's always sort of downbeat and depressing, and it feels like everything is kind of hopeless. So I try to tell stories that even if they do go into a dark direction, there's always some relay to show that there's a little bit of hope in the end, that things in real life may not be easily wrapped with a bow, but at the same time, you could tell something that maybe the issue may not be fully resolved, but at least there's a pathway to some sort of reconciliation, some sort of peace, inner or external. And that's what I try to do here, is especially with these characters going up against some very powerful folks that are got their hands in different parts of law enforcement and politics. I try to show that, no, sometimes you got to have a little bit of an edge to take a stand, and the confidence and the know-how to take a stand when those powerful allies are against you.
Yeah, I love it, because we all live on a planet that has great challenges for all of us. I mean, if just making a film, if you want to really grow, go make a film, right? I bet you'd give that advice, right? I mean, you got to grow in so many ways to learn a craft.
100%. I mean, a lot of my best teachers, one of which is Booker Madison, who was one of my instructors at New York Film Academy, and now he's making films for Tubi and BET, and he's still teaching. I feel like he's got a great balance between managing his career and doing some successful work that is getting to the masses. And I am so proud of him. And that's what I aspire to be, is somebody that could get out there, make works, but always learning, always trying to see what's new, what's exciting, what could enhance the things that I have available to me, and be able to tell my stories without being so limited by the budgets or limited by some producer telling you, oh, it's got to be like this or that. I should be allowed to have that freedom and flexibility to tell the story as I intended. And when you have to compromise, you know, you level it out. You try to find a common ground with the vision with your actors and your crew. It's simple as that.
That's good. Well, The Last Vendetta is the end of the trilogy. So I'm going to encourage my audience to go and watch it this weekend or sooner. And I know I'm going to do the same, by the way. And I want to know what's next for you. But before I do go there, I'm going to take a quick break. So we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone watching at home. We're here to remind you that if you or someone you know were injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have live agents available right now to answer your questions and tell you how much your case is potentially worth. Hi, I'm Gina Belich, here with spokesman and TV personality Tom Mustin with us in the Help Center. So, Tom, phones are really busy over there. Tell us what kind of calls you're seeing.
Well, Gina, first off, thank you for having me here in the call center with you. We always enjoy talking to the viewers and getting folks the compensation that they deserve. You know, we're seeing calls about all kinds of accidents, but the most common by far has been car accidents. So if you or someone you know were injured in an accident that was not your fault, give us a call right now. You'll speak with a live person. They'll answer any questions you have and tell you if you have a case and how much your case is potentially worth.
Thanks, Tom. All right, folks at home, you heard it. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now.
Hi, folks. Joe Namath here. Did you know that I wear hearing aids? I love my hearing aids, and I am here to help you get a deal on the same brand I wear.
Don't waste thousands on expensive hearing aids when you can get MD Hearing's revolutionary Neo hearing aids for just $297 a pair. The Neo is a true hearing aid, not an amplifier, with rechargeable technology many customers say is superior to more expensive models. And you can get two Neo hearing aids with a 45-day risk-free trial, free shipping, and free lifetime U.S.-based support for only $297. The Neo is nearly invisible with its tiny in-the-ear canal design.
Call my friends at MD Hearing and get the over-the-counter hearing aids that I use for you.
Call now and get not one, but two Neo hearing aids for just $297.
800-789-7885. Again, that's 800-789-7885.
Welcome back, everybody. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Andrew Joseph. He's a filmmaker. He's got a new the end of the trilogy, actually, The Last Vendetta, has just been released, and it's a I hope if you just joined us, listen to the interview, because this is we've covered a lot here. Andre, what's next for you? You're closing out this trilogy. You know, I guess let me ask you before I ask you what's next. What did you learn in this trilogy that you're gonna either incorporate more of or never do again?
I would definitely say the one thing I'm never going to do again is load all of my footage into one hard drive, because I had a little incident with that. Long story short, I actually, the hard drive I had with the film had crapped out on me during post-production, but I was so fortunate my cinematographer had a backup of all my files. So I actually had to re-edit the movie once over, and Demetrios was such a lightsaber, my cinematographer. But I'd say the thing that I learned coming out of it is that there is a way for me to have an amazing crew. And I think communication is so key with the actors, to let them know ahead of time, you know, this is your character, this is what we're expecting from you. Because maybe not everybody was always on the same page with one another. And I do feel like we got as close as we could to get that right. But, you know, every now and then there were things that may have been a miscommunication or two. So I really understood like the importance of rehearsals and the importance of read-throughs and making sure things are really well defined and in fine-tuned comb with the script.
I love that, man. Okay, this is good insight. All right, I got about a minute. So what's next for Andre?
Well, the things I could definitely say that I'm not having to hold back on. So my short film Dismissal Time, I'm still trying to get played into schools as we speak. So I'm still working on that. I have a Christmas-themed short film called Brooklyn Lights, which I shot last year. It's kind of a romantic tale, but not what you would expect for a Christmas movie. And that I plan to put out at the end of this year. And we have a Western that's been in development for a long time called American Gunslingers. We've been constantly, you know, starting and stalling on it, but I'm hoping maybe through this or through other promotions that we could get the support needed financially to get that movie off the ground in the coming months.
That's awesome, man. Listen, I have so enjoyed this interview, and thank you so much for being here. Much success on The Last Vendetta and, of course, the trilogy and everything you're doing in the future. For my audience, you can see The Last Vendetta right now on Tubi, and you can also get it on Amazon and Flix TV, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Thank you again, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Ken. Appreciate it.
And I want to thank all of you for joining us today. It's a great day for you to pass this video or this show on to people that you care about and love. So we encourage you to do that. And until next time, continue to see the unseeable, know the unknowable, and you'll be able to do the impossible.